nervous. No pressure. This is not live, is it? I imagine whatever I say, you could just edit it out. Let's try it a few ways. Lou, are you in the booth?
I am.
All right, good. You know what, Lou? Let's just play around with it and see if we can get it right. Get this clip package on, and then let me go home. All right?
Yeah.
All right.
Ready.
All right. Count me in.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Wu-Tang. I'm just with you, Lou. Let's do it again. We're gonna do it again. We'll get it right.
Here we go, dude. 5, 4, 3, 2.
You know, when I was a comedian starting out in Washington, D.C., right here in this city, 1988, I'll never forget this. There was a comedy club owner that banned profanity from his comedy club. He said it offended his audience, and this was a cause of major concern for all the comedians in the circuit. And we all called a meeting, and we had the owners come, and it was the club owners, and it was the comedians. It was the classic labor dispute. The club owners laid out their case. There cannot be profanity in these clubs because that offends people. And there's a comedian who's still a good friend of mine to this day. He lives right here in Washington, D.C. He stood up and he said, he's black, I should tell you, because it's important to the story. He says, I use profanity because I live a profane lifestyle. He says, I don't have an insect infestation in my house. I have roaches. My favorite comedians are like musicians, and the audience is their instrument. And the music they make is your laughter. And that's the laughter that I scored my entire life to. So now, some of my favorite American comedic composers. Welcome to the Midnight Miracle.
Patrice O'Neill, Keith Robinson, Rich Voss, Jim Norton, and Colin Quinn. I'm doing a set at the Boston, and this is like when I just started getting into some of the rooms. And they were like, little dummy, are you in any clubs yet? And I was like, I got a set tonight at the Boston. You know, I've just been hanging out at the cellar every night talking. And they was like, we're going to come check you out, little dummy.
An early mentor of Kevin Hart was a man named Keith Robinson, who still lives in New York today, but is from Philadelphia. From the day he met Kevin when he was a young comedian, he referred to Kevin as Little Dummy.
I was like, oh man, I'm so excited. These guys, I can't believe it, man. These guys are my friends. They're gonna come. They're gonna come and support me. This is amazing. I can't believe this. And it's like four people. It's like four people in the crowd at the Boston Comedy Club. And I got to do this set. It's like 12:45 a.m. And I'm still going to go and give him my all because that's what you're supposed to do. I just got in. And I'm telling a joke. And I remember hearing Patrice O'Neill in the back. And he goes, ugh. And I'm like, I'm like, what? What was that? Right? So I still try to keep on. So then Keith goes, ah.
Oh.
And like, then after that, Patrice gets louder. He's like, make it stop. And I'm still trying to go through my bits, and they're just getting louder and louder. And out of nowhere, phone book comes flying to the stage.
That's a thing in comedy?
This wasn't a thing.
It was not a thing.
It's just what they found.
Oh, I thought you meant metaphorically
speaking.
An actual phone book.
He threw an actual fucking phone book. And he was like, we've had enough. He's like, let these people out of here.
Yo. Tell them. In music, the same story happened. It's the Bird Revelation. Charlie Parker, somebody threw a cymbal.
A cymbal at him, yeah.
And that motherfucker, when they threw the cymbal at him, was so upset. It was so insulting that he sequestered himself. He practiced, he practiced, he practiced. That nigga came, played Salt Peanuts, and invented bebop in a single solo.
Swear to God, the same level happened. Like, after they did that, I went back and I remember fucking questioning all those jokes because they trashed every fucking joke. Remember, I had the joke about a midget. And they was like, oh, really, you're a genius? A midget joke? Tell us, what did the midget do again?
You know you're real scared if you call a midget mister.
I'm falling for it every time. They're like, tell us what he did again. Tell us what he did again. I'm like, he walked in the door, and then I was like, hey, midget. And they was like, then what? Tell us again.
You call him midget mister.
And then Voss came in. He was like, you lost me. Start over. Yeah, what did midget do?
I'm scared if you call him midget mister.
They just kept killing me. And I remember going back, and I was like, fuck them. I'm going to figure this shit out. And I started redoing the set. And I took all the jokes they considered hacky jokes out.
I hung out with the midget for 6 more nights.
I got some real stories from him. I came fucking back and the set started getting stronger and stronger and the respect level started to grow, but it was never said. It was understood.
Say it with your chest, little ass nigga.
Do you remember Jim Florentine and Jim Norton had this ability, they could get the crowd to turn on you? Because they would sit on opposite sides of the room and they would start groaning your jokes. Like you do a punchline, then they go, ooh. And then they get everybody in that section, oh, come on. They would do that.
Comedy is not like hip hop. No comedians have shot each other. I used to hate Patrice. I know you guys love him. I used to hate his fucking guts. Oh my God. That guy always used to push my buttons in a way that nobody else could. Like, you could see him.
He did that with everybody.
That's what made him great.
Listen, that's exactly what happened. Finally, he hit the combo. Boop, 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 boop. I snapped. Yo, fuck you, nigga. You always got something about to say. Tidy, blah, blah. I mean, I was screaming on him. And, you know, he's a big dude. I was a little skinny guy. He's a big dude. He goes, day, day, day. I got quiet. He goes, I talk to everybody this way. and I started saying something. I thought about what he said, and we both start cracking up laughing like, yo, yes, you do.
But that's what I was thinking the whole time y'all telling these stories is that as comedians, the laugh, the ha-ha, that's really the end goal. All the mean shit, all this shit, this shit at the end of the day is just fucking funny.
It's funny, but you have to be a strong person to get it. Like, I remember they pushed Burr's button. They told Burr that every time he ate chicken, it was like, we had to sell him. It was like, you can't eat.
That was you. You were saying
that. Said they.
That was you. You're trying to put it on them. That was you. One time, this is how bad the cellar was. The cellar was so bad, you couldn't even get nourishment. I had to think about how I ate for the rest of the time. I was just sitting there, and all of a sudden, he goes, yo, look how Burr eats his chicken wings. I hate the way you eat. I never enjoyed food less. They trashed my whole fucking meal.
I was saying Burr.
I was trying like, to get it in my beard.
I was like, Jesus Christ, Burr is sick. Look how he's eating that chicken. The respect that I give to my comedic peers that sit at the top are there for a reason. There's work behind it. Bill Burr is a fucking machine and...
No. I've never had to work for anything. I'm white as hell. My grandparents owned 20th Century Fox.
Well, that's not...
And they just opened the gates and they said, whatever you want to make, Bill. You just come in here. This business can't wait for a balding redhead.
Now, wait, Bill. Okay, the years ago, there was a night I was waiting to go on at the cellar. And Bill was up. And I don't really watch comedians like that, which people think I'm bullshitting, but I just, you know what I mean? Not because I don't like them, but if you're about to go on, you in your own headspace and there's all kinds of crazy shit. Everyone's different. But this particular night, I watched him. And Bill, tell him what I said to you after. I completely remember this. Do you remember?
Yeah, no, I didn't know you were watching me, thank God, because I would have bombed. because I was intimidated by how good all of you got, you, Dave, Louie, and all you guys were then, because I was new.
Don't say Louie, we'll get in trouble.
I always say Louie. Jesus Christ, what else can they take from him? guy just wants to tell some jokes and people want to come see him, you know? Right. You can avoid him easily. What is the problem? Anyway, so now that I ended my career, what's the question?
No, that first night, we were sitting on the steps of the cellar.
Yeah, and I came walking out. And I remember I saw, I was like, oh, fuck, I hope you didn't hear that. And then you were just, you know, laid back Dave. You said something like, your point of view is so fucking dope. And I was like, oh, my God. And then you were like, it's going to take you longer to get there, though. But if you stay doing what you're doing, when you hit, you're going to have staying power.
So true.
And then I held on to that fucking statement for like the next, I don't know, 6-7 years on the road when I play a half-filled funny bone. I still remember being in this one, just watching the waitresses, you know, the cigarettes, counting up the checks and shit. And I'm just having this feeling like, am I this guy who's not going to make it? Did I pick the wrong thing? I can't do this anymore. I would just think, it's going to take you longer. But when you hit, I just kept thinking, Dave thinks I'm funny.
But I called it. And I'll tell you what I saw. And I don't remember the specific jokes of this, that, or the other. But I remember that I had never seen a white comedian talk about race the way he did. With no animosity, no hatred. But even for me as a black dude, it was illuminating. And it was honest. And it was like ballsy as fuck. And I was looking around like, does anyone else notice this? Nobody sounded like that.
My big thing is if I say something in that world or whatever, even like politically, if I get a certain kind of white guy in the crowd, I start hearing him going like, yeah, all right. Like that type of shit. Then I'm like, all right, I'm not saying it like that. So then I shit on him, going, I don't know how you just heard what I was saying, but I'm, you know, and they start yelling, build the wall, like, because like when you say stuff, no, but like when you say something, you can't control how somebody hears it, because it goes into their whole, I always say it's like drugs that have been stepped on, you know, it gets cut with their whole childhood, all of their experience. Like when I used to first doing the bits when I first met my wife, and it was just classic fish out of water, right? Going up to Harlem to meet her, and as the numbers got higher and then you got into triple digits, the old school New York, it's just, there was no more me. And I was just like, yeah, it was fucking crazy. So the whole joke was just me being scared and describing the neighborhood and my experience. And I remember I was in Florida and how the white guy heard it. He came up to me. He's like, man, I like you. You ain't afraid of black pussy. And that's how he heard it. And I was just sitting there like, that is not even remotely what the fuck I was saying. But it was liberating to hear him say that, because then it was just like, if he's gonna be that far away from what the fuck I'm saying, then it's not my job to babysit you. You know what I mean? So like a lot of people, I think on the left, are doing that. They're like trying to babysit crowds and trying to babysit performers and trying to stick you in this hallway that you can now create in, because like if you don't say these words, they're not gonna think it or not. And it's just, it's stupid. I think they're trying to solve an unsolvable problem, unfortunately.
No, you're very direct. Bill's shit is, his point of view is not only strong, but it's you.
I got that style from doing hell rooms.
A hell room is an unwinnable situation. I once played a place called the There was a salad bar right in front of the stage. If you could imagine, while I was doing stand-up, there were people making salad 2 feet in front of me. Well, that's a hell room.
And it was a way to shut people up, as you would say something fucked up to set it up, and then they would stop. What the fuck's he gonna say? Thinking it was gonna be a train wreck. You know, to lead him right to go left or lead him left to go right. I started doing that. You know, remember all those gigs back in the day?
Listen, when you brought up the Boston, I remember you at the Boston.
No, that was a great room.
The fact that you were even doing black rooms back then, it's like this guy, it's just, most white comics feel like, oh, I'm not welcome there, or it's not like, I don't know what the fuck white comics were going through.
Well, first of all, who I listened to growing up, I listened to all those Richard Pryor albums, so like his albums were so live, like I pictured the crowd. So that's what a crowd sort of looked like. And then when I started in Boston, whatever, I got to know Patrice. And then Patrice and Keith and them would always give me shit, saying I wasn't as funny. Like the black rooms were harder and blah, 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 blah. And I just got sick of them saying it. So it's like, all right, I'll go over and do those. I felt like I was like in an inferior league.
Young, aspiring comedians need to hear what you're saying right now, because if you love comedy, you'll talk to anyone that's willing to listen to you. You don't discern. Like, you know the difference between crowds, but they're all crowds, and you want to talk to all of them.
I heard Bill talking about in an interview if comedians collectively bought ad time on cable news networks.
Oh, yeah, that was the problem, that we became these easy targets because everybody that was really doing the stuff, pharmaceutical companies, oil companies, and all that, advertise on them, so they leave that alone, and then we were just out there twisting in the wind, and it was so easy just to take a joke, and then you put it on the morning news, you know, with some soccer mom watching it, they're obviously going to get offended. So I wasn't serious, but I was joking that if we bought ad time on Fox and CNN, all of that shit would go away because they're not going to criticize people that they're making money off of.
I think because of the two guys that are sitting here outside of myself, a fucking Dave Chappelle and a Bill Burr, what they do is they're unapologetically not only honest, but extremely adamant about getting a point across that it's okay to just disagree.
But you are too.
No, I am now. I'm saying I don't want to speak. I don't want to speak about myself. I'm saying about you guys. You're unapologetically honest about this is how I see shit. I'm not saying that you gotta see shit like me, but this is how I see it. And if you notice, when Bill just talked about Louis, it's a very easy choice to just not go.
And if you at home watching this shit on Netflix, remember, bitch, you clicked on my face.
Or to just not watch it. Or to just not buy a special or a ticket. It's a very easy choice. But people are forgetting that you have that choice. You're acting as if you have to support the individual that says things that you just don't like. And that's not the case.
That's exactly right. Like, even if you don't consume it, it should exist. Last night, I thanked my lucky stars I was hosting the shows. Bill, 100 nights off, threw all fastballs.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you know what's fun is knowing that people's phones were locked, so you could truly have the governor off, which I cannot remember. Like, these fans of all of this shit are so fucking themselves out of so many better shows that they could have watched. Everybody turned into like J. Edgar Hoover and just tries to rat people out and tries to fucking catch you. And they do the shit that the news does. They deliberately take it out of context.
People thought I was crazy years ago when I started taking home. I was the first one to start taking phones. I took the fucking phones years ago because I said, you're not.
Hold up, you took it before Dave?
I asked
him. He took it more successfully than Dave.
See, this type of shit rappers argue about.
Admit it.
Who did it first?
Right.
Listen, Dave locked them up.
Right.
Dave got the professional side of locking them up. I kicked people out of shows.
I was the first nigga with fat shoelaces.
What I was trying to say was, it's a beautiful experience out there. Before we get back to your accolades of what you did first,
Jesus
Christ, and your fucking IMDb page, you just hijacked that whole story.
I don't like the job.
Right, wait a minute.
I'm going to eat in front of you tonight just to
like
fucking
Bill,
annoy you.
Bill's eyebrows have been disappearing through this whole podcast. They just keep fading away. He's losing hair as the minutes go by.
Keep tagging that joke. You'll get a joke out of that at some point. You're wearing the same outfit as my daughter. He has a fucking tie-dye fucking two-piece. How many white women do you have to fuck?
All right.
Jesus Christ.
I gotta let that sit. I can't
That's
come right
enough
back.
Of that. But just let the record show my wife has a similar outfit on. All right. Now, let's move on.
Yo, Yasin, what's up, bro?
Paige, tell him the studio downstairs that I can't see the name on the...
Who calls into their own show?
Just press all the buttons.
You are such a Karen for saying that. Michelle Wolf is exposing herself as a Karen. Just press all the buttons.
Press all the buttons.
What's happening? Am I interrupting? I'm late as fuck. What's happening, y'all?
Well, we're just wrapping the show up, nigga. What are you doing? Are you just in time for the prayer?
To the one who has created the all, you know us better than we know ourselves. And we know ourselves better than others know or pretend to know us. So, Pardon us for our shortcomings, whether they be known or unknown. Make us better than whatever they say, and do not make us responsible for whatever they say. Amen. Amen. Amen.
When I was younger, I wasn't a big Pryor head. I knew who he was. I mean, I'm from the culture. I thought it was funny and all that. But the older I got, the more I was like, this is fucking amazing.
Right.
Not that he got to this thing first. It's not the way he engaged the audience. It was more about the way he was approaching his life, how he was throwing himself against the world that he felt hated him.
Yeah.
That he hated. You know, the fucking multitudes of heartbreak. Like, the more I learn about this guy, I'd be like, yo, this guy is fucking wild. And if you're a practitioner of stand-up comedy, he makes you love it more. Because, you know, that joke he says, I kiss show business every day. Show business, you fine bitch, he says.
I always felt like he and Carlin were like that duality, because Pryor was so visceral. So much of it was so emotional. But with Carlin, it was technique. He was Baryshnikov, verbally.
I think that at the bottom of both wells, there was a broken heart.
Yeah, no question.
Carlin, one time on stage, he was saying, you know, they compare me and Pryor all the time. You know, I had a heart attack, Richard Pryor had a heart attack. He had another heart attack, I had a heart attack. He set himself on fire, I said, fuck that, I'm having another heart attack.
The night that George Carlin died, I was walking into the Comedy Store as I had found out he passed away in Santa Monica. An alert went off on my phone, mm-hmm. and everyone kind of gets those alerts at the same time.
Yeah.
And everyone just kind of looked at each other, and I turned right back around and left the club. I said, I'm not working tonight. Out of respect, the night that Gary Shandling died, I was taping my special, so I couldn't walk out. And the saddest part is that I found out the next day he was supposed to be there that night. He had a ticket.
So you killed this motherfucker.
No. He probably died, so he didn't want to see my set. Fuck you, Dave Chappelle. I'm out.
Let's pause here a moment to drink a toast to human beings around the world and what makes them laugh.
And now, the closer.
Also, y'all did some nasty-ass jokes on my ass, too. Oh, yeah, y'all didn't think I saw some of these motherfuckers. Since you love me so much. I remember this one. It's strike the match like this. Said, what's that? Richard Pryor running down the street.
There's a famous story about Richard Pryor trying to meet Sammy Davis Jr., waiting outside of his hotel room all night, and then finally ended up meeting him and smoking cigarettes with him, and Sammy Davis Jr. giving him an encouraging pep talk. But you imagine that you meet this kid, and if you're Sammy Davis, and you have no idea, this kid's about to fucking revolutionize the genre that he's taking on, and all he wants to do is meet you. You inspired him. When I was 19 years old, I opened for Richard Pryor. I met him before the show. He said my name, which was amazing. He goes, Dave Chappelle, thanks for being here. I'm like, oh my God, like, thank you, man, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And I could see that he was sick. He was using a cane. So I said to myself, I'm gonna throw the fight tonight. I don't wanna kill. I just wanna do just good enough to get him warm. But at that time, I had come to New York City to make it. The mantra is bury everybody. But boy, not this guy. I wouldn't even try. It wouldn't even occur to me. I'm gonna throw the fight, I say. And I did. I did all right. On purpose. Even though I wanted to kill in front of him, I just did all right. Richard Pryor, then they go, ladies and gentlemen, they introduce him, they say,
two most beautiful words in the world of comedy. Richard Pryor.
He comes out to that song, I'm Calling You. AT&T used to use it in commercials. A real dark, eerie song. This is what he walks out to. No upbeat, nothing happy. And he goes on. You could tell it wasn't his night. Just wasn't feeling it. And then he stops. And he says, I want to do this for you guys, but I'm sorry, he says. He says, I can't. And you could hear a pin drop in the room. And the nigga in the back of the room stood up.
and said it like he wanted to fight. He said, "We love you, Richard." My man, the place exploded. I've never, to this day, seen anything like it. It exploded. The longest, loudest, most sincere ovation. And then I understood what I was seeing. Oh, this is his last tour. And they want to say goodbye. It's went on and on and on and on. And if I hadn't been there that night, if I hadn't seen that show, I would not have known that was something to want. But ever since I saw it, I said, that's what I want. More than anything, that relationship that I was seeing play out, I'm like, now that's valuable. It was actual love. We don't care if you're good or bad, nigga. We just need to see you again. And I did see him do stand-up after that, like once. And it was a similar type of experience, but that night, he was feeling it, and he was killing. And every comedian I ever respected, this is the first time I'd ever seen Eddie Murphy in the room. Arsenio Hall was there, Whoopi Goldberg was there, Robin Williams was there, and everybody, all the way down to young Dave Chappelle, packed into that room, and he was killing it. But that's what I wanted. And I think it informed the way I approach not my entire career, but definitely the stand-up. You have to give a lot to get something like that. It was crazy. If you saw it, it was mind-blowing. I've never seen anything like that. It was actual love. I saw it. It was actual love.
Did you realize at that time what effect you were going to have on jazz? You're going to change the entire scene in the next 10 years?
Well, let's put it like this. No, I had no idea that it was that much different. That's my first conception, man. That's the way I thought it should go. And I still do. I mean, of course, it could stand much improvement. Most likely in another 25, maybe 50 years, some youngster will come along and take the style and really do something with it, you know?
Could you take it in, knowing that you are that to someone?
I couldn't even wrap my mind around it, but
you are, and all of you are. Know that you have that relationship. You took that inspiration from all those people, and you took that intentionality and put it into your art, and now you represent that. You're at the level now. You're a mature enough artist in person. You have a record of experience and creation long enough and deep enough to be that person for someone. And could you take that in?
I couldn't. You know, the one of the beauties of the paradox of Richard Pryor, and I think about it when I go through hard shit and shit like that. Like, now, he's not a biblical figure or something, but you know what he is to people in our genre. And I'll think to myself, my hero felt so bad about himself once that he lit himself on fire. Just keep going.